This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Also, the Wes Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wesexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 63, Irregular Stain.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, here we are again, and welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
Wait a second, that means I'm Burt Walder.
Ha! You've eliminated the impossible.
And whatever remains, however untrue, must be improbable.
Yes, and we are improbably here again for our monthly doodad, our monthly get-together, our monthly windbag fest.
Ah, the gas yes. Bag cometh.
And we've got an amazing show lined up for you this time around. But before we get to that, just a reminder, if you'd like to get in touch with us, there are innumerous ways, all under the I Hear of Sherlock banner, whether it's on Twitter, Facebook, or Tumblr. Just slap in I Hear of Sherlock in any of those, and you will find us.
Yeah.
Of course, you can also reach us at ihearofsherlock@gmail.com. And what else? Oh, the phone. Those phone things still work,
yes.
Don't they?
774-221-READ, 774-221-7323. It won't do you any good to call us and ask us to stop, because we won't. But other comments are always welcome, and we'd love to play them on the show.
Indeed. And of course, feel free to look us up on iTunes at bit.ly/IHearOfSherlock. Leave us a review. Recommend us to friends. If you're enjoying yourself, if you're having a good time here, we know we are. And really, that's all that matters.
That's right.
I think what matters even more is the subject of this show,
good
episode
God.
63. What are we calling it again?
I think we're calling it Irregular Stain.
And why would that be?
Well, it's something that's known only to me and my dry cleaner, but for the rest of you, it's because of the Baker Street Irregulars manuscript series, which earlier this year has produced a facsimile of the original manuscript of The Second Stain, attributed to a noted literary agent, Arthur Conan Doyle, edited with an introduction by Andrew Solberg and Robert Katz. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually speak somehow, if our Ouija board was pointed towards that particular dimension and could actually
speak? I seem to remember we spoke to them on episode 50, was it not?
It seems so long ago.
A golden passage. They co-edited the eighth in the series of the BSI manuscript about the golden pince-nez. Mm. And what do you say we try and conjure them up for this time around?
All right, I'll shake my crystal and see what happens.
This is where you insert the harp music.
Oh, okay, I can do that. Well, Andrew, Robert, you're looking both very well. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
It is. And despite the fact that we were on before, you have us back.
That's right. And you're going to keep coming back until we get it right.
So this is great, because when we were at the BSI weekend last year, that would be in 2013, of course, Golden Passage just came out, and the two of you were already plotting your return to the editorship for the volume we're going to talk about now. And I think the level of enthusiasm and excitement that we heard from both of you was just tremendous. I think we'd just like to tap into that a little bit now as we begin the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, and one way, if you don't mind, that I would like to start is for those folks who are listening who may not ever have seen the manuscript series, and certainly probably have never seen an original piece of an original holographic item signed by and handled by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. What's the motivating drive behind the manuscript series, behind doing something as arcane as capturing images of a manuscript and looking at the content, and you know, at that level, what's it all about?
Well, I long before the manuscript series, I actually loved the Lion's Mane, which was another reproduction of one of the Sherlock Holmes manuscripts. I don't remember who it was done by, but
I think it was England. I think it was done in England.
Yeah, and it was wonderful because it gave me the opportunity to actually see what one of Conan Doyle's Sherlockian manuscripts looked like. And it was just phenomenal. And I think the BSI was smart to start the manuscript series and give not only the opportunity to see the manuscript, but also really wonderful articles about each of the stories.
What comes when you look at a manuscript? Why would anybody be interested?
Well, it gives a sense of the way Conan Doyle wrote, the way he made corrections to his manuscripts. And it's not just the manuscript itself. It's also a fabulous article by Randall Stock, for example, on how the manuscript was written and what Conan Doyle was doing at the time he wrote the manuscript, and then the provenance of the sale of the manuscript and how it came down to, in this case, Haverford College.
And there are also differences between what Doyle wrote and then occasionally scratched out and rewrote, and then what made its way to the galleys, which this book is unique in having, and what made its way from the galleys to the Strand and to the Doubleday. And it's really it wasn't an unchanging process. What originally was put on paper in ink by Conan Doyle is not necessarily what we first read.
Yeah.
What was put on ink by maybe not Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
Exactly. In this case, there were 5.5 pages that were written in another hand.
Yeah.
And you get a chance to see that other hand, and we discuss who it was and how it came to be there.
Yeah. You know, there's always this point when you finish reading a great tale, a great story, a great paragraph, any kind of great bit of writing. You know, you put it down and you just find it very satisfying. And it seems to you in that moment that it sprung complete from someone's pen. But the actual path that the tale takes from idea to manuscript to print can be very interesting in and of itself, and there are so many detours and so many corrections and so many amendations. I mean, for part of Conan Doyle's writing history, of course, we have that with The Hound, because there's more recorded there. He goes on a trip, he's with Fletcher Robinson, he hears this tale, he thinks of it this way and that way, he introduces Holmes to it later. But here in The Irregular Stain, you know, you really do have that unique opportunity almost to look over his shoulder and see the things that were changed right before production, and also what happened as the manuscript itself was put together in this, which I'm sure we'll come back to, this other hand that you mentioned. So, you know, for those of us who love these tales and stories, this is almost an opportunity to look over the shoulder of the writer at a critical moment.
So take us to the inception of your collective desire to cover this as part of the manuscript series. Whose idea was this, and how did you kind of convince each other to go along for the journey once again?
Well, this is really a great story because before we finished the working on the manuscript book, The Wrong Passage, the last book that we did together, we were talking about how much we were enjoying it. And Bob said, go ahead, Bob.
Well, actually, Andy, you said, gee, this was so much fun, we ought to think about doing this again. Now, that was Andy's big mistake, because I already had a not very hidden agenda. Going back to my early days, quite literally, I'm an alumnus of Haverford College, which is out on the suburbs of Philadelphia. Going there for me was one of the wonderful experiences of my life. And it just happens to be the alma mater of Christopher Morley, who was the founder of the Baker Street Irregulars. And I knew from 40 years ago, because I had been shown it, that the library at Haverford College owned the manuscript of The Second Stain, which Morley had purchased and donated to the college. And it's always been an interest of mine, even call it a goal, and certainly a goal that became much clearer once the BSI manuscript got underway, that I really wanted to see the manuscript of The Second Stain in print, particularly because it would also, given the way that the manuscript series books are structured, give us an opportunity to discuss the role of Haverford College in the Baker Street Irregulars. And as we'll perhaps talk in a few minutes, it's a much more than just Christopher Morley and his brothers, who also went to Haverford, starting this organization. It goes on, it's much more complicated. So I had always wanted to do this, and when Andy said, well, we ought to do this again, I said, yeah, let's do The Second Stain. And Steve Rothman, great friend of all of ours, and editor of the sponsor of this show, the Baker Street Journal, had been talking already with the folks at the Rosenbach Foundation, who have the Empty House manuscript, about working with them and getting that manuscript into the BSI manuscript series. And he'd also had some preliminary discussions with the folks at Haverford College. So Andy and I got together with Steve, and we talked with John Bergquist and at BSI Books, and of course Mike Whalen. And after some discussions, we decided that the original plan was to publish, the next book was going to be The Empty House, and then perhaps The Second Stain, if that could be worked out. But Steve was still in negotiations with the Rosenbach, so we all decided that what we would do is Steve would continue to negotiate with the Rosenbach, but he gave us the name of his contact at Haverford, and Steve's had a lot of interaction with the Haverford Library over the years. Steve gave us his contact, and we got in touch with them, and, you know, perhaps because I'm an alumnus and I've been active, we were able to secure permission from the good folks at Haverford College to scan the manuscript and publish it through the manuscript series. So it was decided that after Wrong Passage came out, that the next volume in the series would be the Second Stain manuscript. And that's really how it got started. This was admittedly something I've wanted to do in some fashion for about 40 years.
And in The Irregular Stain, you tell a little bit of that story. Do you want to tell a little bit about how you first handled the manuscript back all those years ago?
Well, I was a history major, and as sort of a graduation present, if you will, the one of the professors of history, a fellow named Ed Bronner, a lovely man, said to me, as he was a history professor as well as being the director of the libraries, said as I was getting ready to graduate, would you like to see the manuscript? And as I think I said in the introduction, if you'd said to me, would you like to see that manuscript, or would you like to see all seven wonders of the ancient world, I wouldn't have had to hesitate for a minute because I wanted to see that manuscript. And Ed took me to the library, and he took it out, and it's, we'll get Andy's comments, but when you're a Sherlockian and you're physically in the presence of one of these manuscripts, it's a remarkable feeling. And maybe, Andy, you can comment how you reacted when you saw it.
Well, it really is a remarkable feeling. I remember the first time I ever picked up a book that was signed by Conan Doyle, and I was cradling it. I couldn't afford it. It was selling, I think, for around $1,500, and I was just cradling it like a baby. It was really a remarkable feeling to be holding something that Conan Doyle held in his hand and he signed, and you get a chance to touch it. And so you can imagine what it's like when you pick up an entire manuscript written by him. I think there are 23 pages or 31 pages, something like that, to this. And it was just thrilling.
Yeah, we use that term, being in the presence of history. It almost becomes cliched. This is one of these times when it's not a cliche. It's real. Mm. You just get a sense that this is the real thing. This is as close to Conan Doyle as we're ever going to get.
And well, now that you've done that, of course, you're more than likely to be contacted by him through a seance.
Or his wife, or Houdini's wife, I think, is the one who's trying to reach me now.
Well, the other thing is that in our case, we actually scanned this manuscript ourselves. We drove up to Haverford one day and scanned it, and there was, as thrilling as it was, we were happy when we were done scanning it and we handed it back to Haverford without having done it any injury at all.
Yeah, this was an amazing experience in its own way, and maybe I'll tell a bit of it. We got permission to do the book, and the folks at the Haverford Library said, come up. It was, I guess, December of 2012.
Yeah.
And Andy and I met at Haverford and went over to the library and met Johnny Inderes, who was at that time the special collections librarian. And John showed us the scanner and takes out this bound volume. It's a very thin, kind of about 11 by 14 sized volume, and shows us the scanner, and we go to work on it. Well, first of all, the book is bound. It's not loose sheets. So in order to do the images, you've got to hold the book open. And, of course, you don't want to break the binding.
The scanner was a flatbed scanner similar to your computer printer, if you've ever scanned anything on your printer.
Yeah. So it was that made it more difficult. And not only did we have to open the book as wide as we could without, of course, breaking it, but Conan Doyle wrote little comments and changes, sometimes sort of way up in the upper left corner of the page, so they were sort of half visible and half bound in, you know, stuck in the bound part, so you couldn't totally see them. So in addition to doing the scan, we took pictures of those things with our cell phones just to provide the crew with as much visible stuff. And then the other thing was that because the manuscript is written in more than one hand, most of the pages are kind of uniform there, as I said, roughly about 11 by 14. But every now and then a page would appear that was literally a scrap of paper. You know, it was maybe like 5 by 8 card size. And that was the next page. And, of course, if you wanted to copy that, you couldn't just put it on the scanner because you'd get that page and the rest of the page behind it. So we had to put in white paper and do all that stuff. And it was a very, very tedious process. And both of us were afraid that we would sneeze on it or tear it or break the binding or do something which was like a mortal sin. And I remember there was one moment where I was holding the thing open and we're trying to get a picture, and in the midst of all this, Andy says, "Do you think this manuscript is worth $1 million or $1.5 million? His timing was impeccable. But we managed to get it scanned, and it turns out inside the folder that had the manuscript, there was also a very neat little note from Christopher Morley to his brother Felix, which is reproduced in the book. We got that copied. And by the time we were done, though, and it took us, what, maybe 3 hours or so?
Yeah, about
like 20-odd pages. We were covered with sweat, and we were just exhausted by the process. And after we were done, I remember talking to Mike Whalen, and he said to me, "Must have been a lot of fun to have done the scan of the manuscript." And I said, "No, I never want to do that again. It was the most frightening thing I've ever done. I was convinced that if anything happened, I would be simultaneously thrown out of both the Baker Street Irregulars and the Haverford College Alumni Association." But we got it done, and it worked out that John Berquist felt that it, because of the appearance of the manuscript, that the coloration and the appearance of this manuscript was one of the better reproductions that he's had in the series. So we were real pleased that it turned out artistically as nicely as it did. But boy, that was one scary job.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mention that, because this is the first, I think, that I've seen in the manuscript series from the BSI that's actually done in color.
Yes.
Is that
right.
Correct?
That's right. This is the first edition that was printed in color. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and
I think
the pages are a little bigger.
They are.
Because the book is physically a bit bigger than the previous ones, which means they didn't really have to reduce it as much.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to put this on the shelf with my other manuscript series, but my shelves are too narrow to accommodate it, so it's got to go on its own shelf now.
But it's worth it.
Well,
I think
it's a place of prominence. Yeah,
John and Mike and Mike Keene, and Steve Doyle and BSI Books just did a really nice job with the production.
Really did. Really
and
did.
One of the reasons why it's so appropriate that this one be in color is partly because we've got that wonderful Sidney Paget illustration that Glenn Maranker owns and scanned for us and let us have as the frontispiece for the book.
That is true. It's that shot of Holmes reaching into the hidden compartment in the floor as the carpet has been whisked away, and Watson kind of looking over his shoulder there. And again, if you've ever had the chance to see an original Sidney Paget up close, the detail and the nuances in color are just amazing, because the reproductions that we've often seen in the typical illustrated Sherlock Holmes volumes are, they're copies of copies of copies, and they're only black and white. And, Glenn's illustration here by Sidney Paget is just, it's tremendous.
It's
really like seeing a totally new picture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the detail you can see in the background and the, the emotion on the faces and everything. It's just really lends to the overall volume.
Yeah, well, Paget, is quite a talented artist. And the process at the time, around the turn of the century, was to take the original art and then through the existing process make a printing plate. But here with the original art, you can see his delicate washes. You can see where he added whites for the highlights. You can see how almost photographic. He was almost emulating a black and white photograph with the depths and the backgrounds. And it really is a reintroduction to the image anew. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
And then what was serendipitous in a way, is that as the word kind of got out through the BSI grapevine that we were working on this project, we learned that there is only one story in the entire canon for which the galleys still exist. They were all the other stories, the galleys had been destroyed. And there's only one story for which there's a complete, well, there's any galleys at all, and this is a complete set. And Kostarazakis was kind enough to, he owns it, to reproduce that and let us use it in the manuscript. And John Berquist, I think, was really made the very good decision to, regardless of the length, to publish the galleys in their entirety. So this is the only time ever that Sherlockians will be able to look at a story from Doyle's handwriting and the other handwriting, but the original handwritten, to the galleys, and then you can take that to the various printed editions. And that's never going to happen again, because this is the only time galleys exist.
Mm. Yeah, and so for those, you know, who may be listening who don't understand the process, basically what was going on around the turn of the century is that Conan Doyle would conceive of a story idea, and in some cases would not immediately transmit that idea into a story. But he kept notes, and for most of the time, the vast majority of his notes are no longer with us. I mean, there are some samples of it. But eventually, a handwritten pen and ink manuscript on paper of various sizes of composition books, depending on what he had at hand, in a very neat hand, would be actually written by Conan Doyle. But the second stain, which would then go to the publisher, but the second stain was a little bit different because it was going to two places. Isn't that right?
Yes. Well, the galleys that were published in this book were actually the galleys that were submitted to the Library of Congress for copyright purposes. Right. So they weren't the galleys that they would print up and then have the author make corrections on.
Right, but before the galleys, there was a typescript, no?
Yes, there was a typescript.
And in fact, there were two of them. I mean, there was an original and a couple of carbons.
Right. Yeah, Conan Doyle typically did three of them.
Yeah. Because in this case, it was going to America as well as eventually mm-hmm. to the Strand.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
And so here we have the manuscript and the galleys that on the American side went to the Library of Congress for the copyright protection.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's really... what you said earlier about he would think of something and not necessarily write it up immediately. In this case, he liked the title, The Adventure of the Second Stain, because he mentioned it in two previous stories. Mm-hmm. And it was only... it was only when he was finishing off the return of Sherlock Holmes that he wrote it up as a real story. It was previously one of those unrelated stories that would get mentioned by Watson from time to time.
The other thing, as we got into it, and I really need to publicly thank Andy for basically putting up with me. through the whole process and just being as supportive as he was, because it was great, was not only did I, as a Haverford alumnus, want to see the manuscript published, but I thought this would really be the opportunity that we'd have for the story of the role of Haverford College and Haverford College alumni and other associated people, their role in the Baker Street Irregulars to be told. And really got to have a lot of fun with that, because one of the ways we went about that was people that we were able to recruit other alumni of Haverford College to contribute to the story. A classmate of mine, Paul Hagen, who's a dean at the Duke University Law School, where our friend Andy Peck is an alumnus, along with Richard Nixon, Paul's a Rhodes Scholar, so he's a classmate of mine, an old friend, and he was kind enough to agree to contribute an article on legal aspects of the story, which is really superbly written. Will Walsh, who many of us know, is a Sherlockian in Westchester and an alumnus of the class of 1984. And he contributed two articles, one of which is a serious article about treason, and the other is a very funny article about where Holmes went to college, and you can guess what he concludes. And then I had the opportunity, which was terrific, for me to work on an article called Mainlining, because Haverford is out in a suburb called the Mainline, about the various people who have been associated with Haverford College who have played a role in the Baker Street Irregulars. And it's co-written, of course, with Steve Rothman, because three of the major players are Chris Morley and Felix and Frank, and I didn't see the point to writing that part of the article myself when we have Steve out there. So he was kind enough to write that part, and then I was able to write the remainder of it discussing people like John Dixon Carr, who attended Haverford for 2 years and then went on to write the official biography of Conan Doyle, the first, you know, approved by the family biography, and then collaborated with, was it Adrian, on pastiches called The Exploits. And there have been several other members of the Baker Street Irregulars over the years who are alumni of Haverford College. Some have passed away, some are still around. And it was a lot of fun for me to get to tell their story. And one of the things that was very interesting is Andy, for many years, ran the BSI Oral History Project, where we interview more senior members of the Baker Street Irregulars in the hopes that this will preserve their stories and their history and provide us with data. And I actually used two of those interviews with Haverford alumni who are also invested Irregulars. One has passed away, one is not an active Sherlockian, but he's still alive. But I was able to use those two interviews to get information to write their sections of that chapter. So that's a BSI project that really helped with this book. And then one of my professors wrote an article about this manuscript 40-some-odd years ago that won the Morley Montgomery Award from the Baker Street Journal. So there are just a lot of people that have in some way or other been associated with Haverford who have played a role, in some cases very significant roles, in our Sherlockian world. And for so me that, to get the chance to be to sort of tell that story was it was a real privilege.
So as you can see, Bob's enthusiasm for being the BSI to bring out the book on the manuscript that was owned by Haverford College is absolutely evident. And when he confided that to me initially, I said, let's make it happen. And it was just a joy to be able to participate in that throughout the whole process.
And we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And what surprises did you have along the way? I'll tell you one of mine.
Go ahead, Bert.
Well, one of mine is apple pie.
Yeah.
It was ours too.
Yeah. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
I think you really spent more time with it. Why don't you start?
Okay, well, Conan Doyle, when he wanted to make edits, he would write apple pie. Periodically throughout the manuscript, you will find apple pie written on the page. And it absolutely has, you know, it obviously has no relevance to the story at hand.
Yeah, sometimes he's covering up words, and he's doing it to make sure that who's ever going to go from his manuscript to a typed version or to a typeset version doesn't actually peer beneath what he's trying to cover up and somehow mistakenly put it into type.
Right.
Do we know why apple pie, though? Why didn't he do chocolate eclair?
Apparently that was his favorite dessert.
About that.
Yeah.
So maybe Sherlock Holmes was American.
The other issue which is discussed at length in the book is that there's another handwriting in the book, in the manuscript, and the article that one of my professors years ago wrote, the late Richard Lumen, wrote an article suggesting that the second handwriting was Dr. Watson. A little more historically accurate was John Lellenberg, many of us know, did many of the books in the BSI archive series, and of course is in his role as agent for the Conan Doyle estate, knew Dame Jean Conan Doyle, Sir Arthur's daughter, quite well. And he showed her a photograph of one of those pages, and she said that was her mother's handwriting.
You have to remember that the book was written in 1904, and Conan Doyle's first wife was not dead yet. And it is suspected that Conan Doyle wrote the story, or at least the part that Jean Conan Doyle wrote. And when I say wrote, I mean he dictated to her. It was at the Golden Cross Hotel where Conan Doyle's mother was chaperoning them.
Yeah, but it's so, you know, it's a wonderful point in the story and in the manuscript because, you know, as our listeners might remember, you get to a point where Holmes has essentially cracked the case and knows where the missing document is and confronts Lady Hilda Trelawney Hope. So you get to a point in the manuscript where Watson writes, her courage was admirable. Even now, she would not own defeat. So it's set up what's to come, which is her explanation of these events and her emotion and her feelings. And it's there that the bottom page of page 23 is gone. And so you just have sort of the top third of the page, and then you turn, and then the rest of the manuscript for a couple of pages is in this completely different hand. And it's all her, mostly her dialogue.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The other thing that I don't want to say was a surprise, Bert, but was in a way sort of a non-surprise, but confirms for all of us something that we've all known, is for me and Andy to have the opportunity to work with all of our contributors confirms just how many amazingly talented people are out there in the Sherlockian world. And it really was great to work with. First of all, we knew the book would be a success from the beginning because Phil Bergham and Randall Stock right off the bat agreed to be on board again. And they're just, you know, the stalwart contributors to this series. They, you know, Phil does transliteration of the manuscript and annotation and all that stuff. And Randall does this amazing story of the provenance. And this manuscript at one point was owned by William Randolph Hearst. And it's a great story. And they've just contributed so much to so many volumes of the series. And then we had, as I said, my classmate Paul Hagen contributed, Will Walsh contributed two articles, one of which was with John Besh, a friend of Andy's from the Dr. Watson's Tin Box, Rod McCaslin, wrote a very nice article about international affairs, and not somebody that's really been as publicly seen, so it was good to have the chance to bring some new people into it. Who else? We don't want to overlook.
Betsy Rosenblatt did a wonderful chapter on marriage and how Lady Hilda could possibly have done what she did.
Yes.
It really was a good cast of characters.
Yeah, and it's really fun to work with these people because what's nice is they all take it seriously. You know, we set what we hoped were reasonable deadlines and everybody worked with those deadlines because it was a production process. And once we're done with the editing, then John Berquist and his crew have to get to work, and that's time consuming. So the sooner we can get material to him, the easier things are for him. And all the contributors work with the deadline, and they were cheerful and cooperative, and not only were worked with us with editing issues, but what was also great was they would communicate with each other and shared ideas. So it was really very unselfish because a lot of the authors got in touch with each other directly and talked about issues and worked things out. So it really was for us a pleasure to work with a really talented and just nice bunch of people.
I was going to say, I have to say, I mean, it was an equal pleasure when we worked on The Wrong Passage. That team was great. And now we're working on a manuscript series book on The Empty House. And, you know, again, we've got a great group of people that are writing chapters for it. And three of them have gotten their chapters in early, and they're wonderful.
They're dynamite, yeah.
That's great. And, you know, in addition to not only the work ethic and the seriousness with which your contributors took the assignment, I think the content itself is pretty serious because, as you know, there's an element of Sherlockian scholarship that can be seen as tongue-in-cheek. And I think what we've got with each one of these manuscript series, and particularly this one, is a lot of very serious, very literate, very insightful articles that make up the book that really make it a piece of gravitas as well as of just a lot of exciting information.
Yeah, well, Bob and I really, one of the things that we tell the authors is that we believe in, you know, canonicity. I mean, we want to make sure that anything they write can be documented in the canon. And for the most part, we're able to have people comply with that. There's one article in here that relates Eduardo Lucas to Sidney Reilly. And we were really tough with the with Rod McCaslin on that one, and making sure that he was able to make his argument in a way that made sense and was convincing. And I think he did a great job.
Yeah, he was very gracious to work with, and you know, I think the end result was a really terrific article.
Yeah. Mm. But we're not loosey goosey on the canonicity issue. We take that part pretty seriously.
That's a technical editing term, right?
Yep.
Yeah, like apple pie. Mm.
Well, and there is this wonderful spot in the manuscript. I guess it's on page 25, where Lady Hilda Trelawney Hope says, "Mr. Holmes, I will tell you everything," cried the lady. Apple pie, apple pie, apple pie.
Yeah. You asked what was one of the surprises. One of the things is that one of the phrases that we use time and time again in terms of what Holmes said to Watson in the regarding the fair sex being Watson's department was an afterthought. Mm. He had crossed something else out and put that in as a change. And it, you know, what a great afterthought.
I mean,
it's become one of the favorite references to the canon. I also thought it was interesting that when Jean Conan Doyle was writing, he dictated one phrase about where he said something like that Lady Hilda took the key out from a desk. And then when he was done, he crossed that out and he added, or he changed it to, she took it out of her bosom. I'm just picturing him not wanting to say that to Jean under the circumstances.
Yeah.
One story we ought to tell, I want Andy to tell it, is how the title came about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Got to tell that, Andy.
One of the things, Mike Whalen has always taken his right or exercised his right of choosing the titles for these books. And so Bob and I, after we submitted everything to John Berquist, all the text, we played What Would Mike Choose? And we went through the story. He likes choosing actual phrases from the story.
Right, like wrong passage. There's a term where, you know, someone goes down the wrong passage.
Yeah, yeah. So we went through the book, the story, and we chose all the kinds of phrases that we thought Mike would choose.
There are about 20 of them, I think, Andy, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, but we limited it down to about a dozen.
Okay, yeah.
And then we, but then we came to the phrase irregular stain. And there was an irregular stain, blah, 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 or an ugly irregular stain or something like that. And we said, how could he choose anything else?
Mm-hmm.
So we sent Mike an email and we told him that we had played What Would Mike Choose? And we said, you know, I mean, it's up to you, but, you know, our choice is irregular stain. And he very reluctantly agreed with us.
This is like man bites dog, you know. I think that to us was the most stunning part of the whole process, was that Mike actually went along with our suggestion for the title. We just couldn't believe it.
That's right.
I'm very glad you didn't take that phrase from Inspector Lestrade when he was addressing Constable McPherson, saying, it's lucky for you, my man, that nothing's missing or you'd find yourself in Queer Street. That's a title for which the world is not yet prepared.
Yeah, I don't think that was on our list of 12.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But that to us was a great moment when Irregular Stain actually was selected.
And you know, I think that's one of the great reasons for us to talk to you, is because we get to find out more about the process and about what goes into, you know, actually creating an entry in the manuscript series than just what ends up on the printed page or what the manuscript looked like and stuff like that. This is, to me, this is, you know, more of the meat behind the whole project.
Yeah.
Well, it's a process and a project, because, you know, Andy and I started with a list of possible topics for contributors, and then once we came up with that, then of course you want to come up with contributors to link to the contributions, and you know, you go back and forth with each other about that, and then when we come up with an actual list of topics and potential contributors, then you reach out to these people, and most are able to do it. Every now and then somebody just has really other commitments and isn't able to, but most people are willing and able to do the project. And then of course there's back and forth with the contributors, because you know, we give them a topic, but these are bright people and they're creative, and they'll look at it and say, well, how about if I take this angle? And it's sometimes somewhat different from what we had in mind, but often turns out a lot better. So you get to work, you know, have that kind of give and take with these people, and it's really a lot of fun. But it is a process.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, Scott, that, I mean, that's one of the nice things about I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, is that, you know, it provides the Sherlockian community, not just on these history manuscript book series books, but on almost everything that you cover. It gives the backstory and the back process, and you know, that's, I think, why we enjoy continuing to listen.
Oh, well, Andy, no need to flatter us. You're already a regular guest.
No.
And you know, one other thing that you know, backstory kind of information or inside stories. Again, something where the co-editors, the pleasure of working with Andy is you know, he's so bright and intellectually flexible, and he's just got so many great ideas that for me to work with him, it just for me is a great pleasure. When we talked about the introduction, the co-editor's introduction, it starts off really with my first involvement, well, my going to Haverford and how I ended up seeing the manuscript, as Bert asked a while ago, and then sort of how Haverford played roles in my Sherlockian life over the years, and how that basically sort of led full circle to coming back to Haverford with Andy to scan the manuscript and do the book. And, you know, traditionally in scholarly volumes of this sort, it's written in the third person. And in writing the introduction, because we thought we'd tell a bit of my own personal story, which I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to do, I guess I mentioned that in a way, I'd like to do it in the first person, but that's really not editorially how things are done, and so I'll try to do it in the third person. And Andy said, "No, let's forget about the formality. The right way to do this is for you to write it in the first person because it's your story." And he encouraged me to do that, and I think it worked out very nicely, and I really got to thank Andy for really telling me that it was okay to do that, because I think on my own I would have written it in the third person because that's how you're supposed to do it, and it would have been a lot drier and perhaps not as real as what I think we ended up with.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of the journey here has been a personal one, Bob. That started really over 40 years ago, as you explained
yes.
earlier in the show.
Yeah, and really close to 50 years ago.
Yeah, so, and that's so important, particularly for this volume. So this is a personal story. It's Haverford's story. It's our story together. But ultimately, and most importantly, it was one where the excitement and the instigation came from you personally, so I think that's right.
Yeah, but I have to thank Andy again for really encouraging me and realizing that was the right way to do it. Because if I'd been left to my own devices, I wouldn't have done it that way, just out of timidity. And that's why it's really fun to have a partner in doing this kind of stuff. It makes things better.
Well, it was really a pleasure. For me to work on it and to help make sure that it happened. As you can see, Bob is really excited about this particular book.
Yeah, I am. I really am.
Well, it's a great effort, and we thank you both for taking the time to show us the behind-the-scenes part of the story.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And if we can have just a moment, Bert,
sure.
to tell you about what's coming up, what we'll be discussing hopefully this time next year.
You mean there's more?
Yes.
There's, you know, son of whatever. We mentioned earlier that while this whole the negotiations with Haverford were going on, Steve Rothman was working with the Rosenbach Foundation on The Empty House, and ultimately he did achieve permission from the Rosenbach Foundation to have that manuscript scanned. I again saw that manuscript myself many years ago, and it's gorgeous. I think it's maybe Clinton Doyle's best handwriting. It's really a work of art. And he got permission from the Rosenbach to reproduce and publish the next volume in the series. Steve, as we all know, is very busy with doing the BSJ. I mean,
right.
It's, you know, every quarter he puts out, well, five times a year, if you count the Christmas annual, he puts out these wonderful volumes. It's a huge amount of work. And of course, we've all been friends with Steve for years. And in discussion, we thought that Andy and I had such a good experience working together that we thought, you know, what's better than two shillings is three. So Steve agreed to work as co-editor with us, so the three of us are in the process now of co-editing the manuscript of The Empty House, and as Andy said, we've already received three contributions, and they're all dynamite. I mean, they're beautifully written. So we're very enthusiastic about the content of this this upcoming volume. It's great to work with Steve because he brings an entirely different perspective to things. He's another personality. And, of course, he has this tremendous editorial experience from the journals. So it's really a very new experience for us, but it's very exciting. And if the other articles are as good as what we've already seen, this book is going to knock your socks off.
That's great.
I'm really impressed with what we've gotten. And we've just got a great crew of people that signed on to do it, and I hopefully some of the kind publicity we've gotten from places like I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere has gotten Sherlockians interested in the series. So, you know, people have been enthusiastic about working with us on it, and we were able to recruit a really, really great bunch of Sherlockian scholars to work on it. So hopefully this time next year there'll be three of us on the air to talk to you about this.
Excellent.
And the cast of contributors to The Empty House is international. Wow. I think for the first time. This is such a great experience to do. I can't explain what a joy it is at this age of my point in my career to find myself co-editing these books with a friend and working with such talented authors. It's really a joy.
Yeah, and we got to give a shout out to John Bergquist, number one, who's the production guy, and just does a wonderful job of putting this stuff together. He's absolutely imperturbable. He's a gentleman. It's just, you know, a lot of fun to work with John. And now Mike Keene is part of that team, and Mike's a very creative and talented guy. He writes the funniest emails imaginable.
We have to give a shout out to Steve Doyle and Mark Gagan,
yes,
who put together,
yes,
a fabulous cover. They're the ones who designed that cover, and it's really beautiful.
Yes. Indeed. So there's a lot of people involved, and it just every one of them has been, you know, truly nice and fun and pleasurable to work with. It's just, in a lot of these projects, and I think Andy mentioned this in the very first introduction to Long Passions, that a lot of times in these books, the people who work together end up as enemies. And I think it's fair to say that all of us, particularly me and Andy, but all of us that have worked on these two books together are much better friends now than we were when we started, because we've just grown closer through working on this project.
That's great to hear, and I think it leaves us with a lot of confidence for what the future in this series brings. So thank you both very much for your leadership and your role in pulling together the right team to do these, and we look forward to many, many more.
Yes.
Well, a quick word from our sponsors now. In as much as this has pretty much been an hour-long segment to promote one of the BSI publications, which includes the Baker Street Journal, of course, we should probably just give a quick mention to bakerstreetjournal.com, where you can go and check out all of the great things that are for sale, including Irregular Stain, the latest in the BSI manuscript series. And, of course, this is the time of the year that you want to get back on track if you have lapsed, or if you haven't yet subscribed to the Baker Street Journal, the irregular quarterly of Sherlockiana, going strong since 1946. Check it out over there at bakerstreetjournal.com.
Yes. It's important to reduce and eliminate anxiety, and it may be the case that you're uncertain as to whether or not you've renewed your subscription to the Baker Street Journal. Mm. So go to bakerstreetjournal.com and take out another subscription, because it's more important to be absolutely certain and eliminate anxiety than to worry about a few paltry dollars. So,
yes.
And the extra copy you can easily give to someone who will be thrilled to receive it.
That's true. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. You have to buy my new book called The Power of Certainty.
I'll be certain to do that.
Yeah. It's in and two volumes. Course... Volume two is the same as volume one.
Well played, sir. Yeah. Well played. Yeah. And, of course, we have our friends from Audible. And for you, listeners of iHose, Audible has a free audiobook download available with a 30-day trial. So it'll give you the chance to check out their service. And I've just pulled some of their most recent entries when I type in Sherlock. And the top three that come up are The Night Calls, The Dark Beginnings of Sherlock Holmes by David Peary. And that's narrated by Ralph Lister. That's an unabridged version. Interestingly, there is a Spanish edition, Las Aventuras de Sherlock Holmes, which is abridged and narrated by a number of individuals. So I would imagine this is a dramatization in Spanish. So if we have any Spanish listeners out there who have been struggling with our English, there is a Spanish edition on audible.com of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And then finally, The Spider Web, Sherlock Holmes Uncovered, Book 4 by Steve Ehrman and narrated by Patrick Kahn. This is Sherlock Holmes relating a story from some of his earliest days before Dr. Watson had come into the scene. And in this tale, Holmes is drawn to Hardwick Hall in the south of England, which has an eerie sobriquet, the Spider Web. And the young detective there matches wits with a wily and dangerous criminal. So to download your free audio book today, go to audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Sherlock for your free audio book.
It's that old music.
Indeed. So what has been going on in the last month in the world of Sherlock Holmes news, Bert? Anything springs to mind?
Sherlock Holmes news. Well, there's been all manner of things, most of which you have found on our Facebook page or our Google Plus presence or our Flipboard. One of the cutest things I think that's happened, well, maybe that's the wrong word, was Steve Mason's needlepoint of our logo, which was a real hoot.
That was tremendous. Now, Steve Mason is a longtime listener that Bert and I had the occasion to meet in January in New York.
Yeah.
And Steve told us that he really doesn't like flying anymore, so he drove from Texas to New York for the BSI weekend. And in order to keep the sanity, I guess, or serenity perhaps, during the drive, Steve listened to, at the time, all 60 episodes of I Hear of Sherlock everywhere, and more than once in some cases. So some might question the sanity and judgment under Steve, but we welcome it here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Well, it's very smart because it's an incentive to drive faster, so it reduces it reduces the total travel time, probably.
Yes, yes. So so that was one thing, that lovely needle point. And we wrote it up on ihearofsherlock.com, so check it out. Some photos up there of the actual work.
Yeah, we've had interesting book reviews on the site. We've also marked some anniversaries, including the 75th anniversary of the appearance of the 20th Century Fox Hound, which first brought Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce to the roles of Holmes and Watson, and was the first, I think, the first Sherlock Holmes film to be actually attempt to recreate the Victorian ambience. I think all of the other films treated Holmes as a contemporary character in the time.
Right, right. Which, you know, the contemporary at the time wasn't all that far off of the actual timing, but still, this is the one that really made the first effort.
Yeah. So.
know. Oh, here's one of my favorites, the Diogenes Club rules. You know, the movie Fight Club, of course. First rule is you do not talk about the Fight Club. So we went through and created the rules for the Diogenes Club.
Yeah.
So that's a fun one to check out there. And, of course, from the tragic side, I think the whole world was following the news of the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. And we drew the connection to Sherlock Holmes, which, of course, that the Andaman Islands were in the news in some cases. And actually, I saw CNN, of all places, try to educate people about the Andaman Islands. And one of the facts that they included in their education was that the Andaman Islands made an appearance in a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah. And thanks to Matt, we had a Sherlockian Lynx compendium in early March that, among other things, touched on Vincent Starrett. But Matt dedicated his post, sadly, to a fellow we stand on the terrace for, Peter Ruber, who passed away on the 6th of March, who was, among other things, a great Starrett scholar.
Indeed. Tying back to the last couple of episodes we've had that have had something to do with Starrett. Yeah. So, good stuff.
Very good stuff.
Is it time to get gassy?
Oh, it may be.
Yes, the editor's gas lamp. Well, as we were looking through the manuscript series entry for The Irregular Stain, we're struck by the preface, which was written by Andy Fusco, who is the general editor for the manuscript series. And he mentioned a letter that Vincent Starrett wrote to Edgar Smith in 1942, talking about a certain dismay and the scholarship and whatnot. And lo and behold, we found that that letter and that take on scholarship was actually written up by Edgar in a previous editor's gas lamp. This is from the volume 3, number 1 of the new series from January 1953. And the title of this is A Perspective on Scholarship. Back in 1942, Vincent Starrett wrote me one of those long, discursive letters in which his correspondents always find even more delightful to read than his published efforts. He talked about the prospects of an Argentine edition of his 221B Studies in Sherlock Holmes, and how these had just taken a turn for the worse because the publishers, prophetically enough, had become, quote, somehow involved with the Nazi sympathizing group, unquote. And he gave some interesting background about the piece on Chinese detective stories, which had just appeared in Bookman's Holiday. Then, apropos of nothing but Vincent Starrett and his devotion to the Baker Street scene, he went on in this vein. And this is where the quote picks up from Vincent's letter. Do you feel a certain mild dismay about the recent trend in our Sherlock scholarship toward facetiousness? I do. It was probably inevitable, but somehow it was more fun, I think, when we pretended to be serious. I know S.C. Roberts feels that way too. In a recent letter, he said that some of the pieces now being written let down the whole subject, and I agree with him. There is almost malice in some of them, I think. It's hard to draw the line, to be sure, between a playful scholarship and outright mockery and malevolence. But there is a line, and it should be drawn. Or are we going to make the whole subject, and ourselves, ridiculous? And here Edgar picks up again. That was a timely warning, and it is one that I like to think the journal has heeded. The pattern set in H.W. Bell's Baker Street Studies, in Starrett's own 221B, and in Profile by Gaslight, out of which the journals slopped over and kept on going, is a pattern we have tried assiduously to follow in the 22 issues of the old and new series that have so far come forth. There are enough facets of the saga still to be explored or to make unnecessary any resort to the facetious or the half-baked. If we approach our task of writing about the writings with the sincerity and the objectivity that Holmes himself would have liked, and to which he gave grudging tribute in his references to Watson's own work, we shall, after all, have more fun than if we try heavily to be funny. And when we do occasionally put our tongue in our cheek, we shall not run the risk of biting it off.
Oh, it's very nice. And it's a very rare thing to have Edgar and Starrett together in the same observation.
That is. That is. And, you know, I mean, spot on for what Bob and Andy were talking about in terms of the seriousness of their contributors and, you know, really what makes the manuscript series what it is. Just that tradition of publishing that the BSI continues on with.
Yeah. Very good.
Excellent. And, of course, we failed to mention one of our other sponsors, the Wessex Press.
Oh, you mean there's more?
It's a pressing matter, this Wessex thing. You know, you can find them at wessexpress.com. And, of course, Mark and Steve are the duo behind the wonderful cover art for the manuscript series. But what's coming up here from Wessex Press is, of course, in September is the Gillette to Brett 4, Basil, Benedict, and Beyond conference.
Oh, yeah, gotta get there.
Check that out for September. They're taking registrations, and of course the whole Sherlock Holmes reference library, the audio recordings we mentioned before, lots of new scholarship. You could do far worse than browsing and sluicing over the offerings at Wessex Press, so check them out.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, speaking of checking out, it could be time that we checked out.
Check it. I put a check mark right next to that one.
Yeah. And that probably leads me to the inescapable conclusion that you're Scott Monty.
Yes, and you must sign your checks, Bert Wolder.
Oh, how did you know? And together we write, yes, the game's afoot.
Afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.